Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, Professor Chad is back to talk about Ned's resignation as Hand of the King. We'll also talk about the ethics of war. What sort of nasty thing would be permissible so far as you could avert war? We will debate that. Steve and I will cover Oathkeeper. Things are really heating up in Season 4. I love this season. Despite last week's episode, Season 4 really is my favorite season of the show. And finally, I will include a short excerpt of my conversation with Jen Doolittle-Wilson in my Bird's Eye View section. She has a slightly different take on Jamie's character than the conversation I've been having with Steve. So I thought I'd include that here. Without further ado, here is Philosopher Chad Carmichael. Chad, have I told you how much the hate Pycelle?
I believe you have, yeah.
I hate him.
I don't remember the reason why you hate him. I don't really like him either, but
I feel like he's an annoyance. I don't feel like he's really fooling anyone. Mm-hmm. Like, he can't even fool Ned.
Yeah.
Everyone knows that he's pretending to be a dotard, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm.
Littlefinger says that he cares only about his own office.
Mm-hmm.
I hate people like that. And I don't feel like he's all that dangerous either. I feel like he's, he's just annoying everyone.
Yeah, there's something kind of passive and cowardly about him.
He's a coward. And I mean, some people in this book can be evil and then you can respect them, right?
Yeah.
You know, like the Hound is like, okay, right. That guy's a murdering son of a bitch, but I absolutely want to see him traipse around the kingdom and be a murdering son of a bitch.
Right, sure.
Pycelle deserves zero respect.
Right.
That's how I feel. However, I do have a question.
Yeah.
Is Pycelle right in this case? It would be a mercy to kill Dany and her progeny because it might prevent a war.
Yeah. Would it be a mercy? I mean, that's a weird question.
I don't know if he says mercy, but he says, look, if we went to war and thousands of soldiers died, a lot worse than killing two people.
Yeah. So there's a common kind of discussion in ethics and philosophy where you look at an example where you would have to do something horrible as a means to a much better outcome. And I guess I'm with the camp that says that's, in at least many examples like that, I don't know about all, but in many examples like that, it feels like, no, you can't go murdering this 14-year-old girl. Forget about the consequences. It doesn't matter what the consequences are. I'm not going to go murder a 14-year-old girl.
That's Ned's position, right?
Sure, that's Ned's position. And I think that's not an uncommon moral sensibility, right?
Well, I'm going to let you finish here, but I'm curious. Go ahead and finish first.
Yeah. So for example, you had people argue this when they were thinking about, dropping the nuclear bomb on Japan at the end of World War II. I think there was a philosopher, Elizabeth Anscombe, who argued, look, you just can't drop a nuclear weapon on a bunch of innocent children, for example, because there were, obviously children in the city. It's just wrong. You just can't do that, even if it would save lives in the long run. There's an example where people have had that intuition where I think it's maybe less clear. It's a tough one.
In many ways, that example is a lot worse, but also different in the sense that you'd be killing millions of innocent people, right? The rationale was that would help end the war.
Trying to end the war, right.
So to me, that's a very different example.
Sometimes historians argue, had the bomb not been dropped, could the war have been brought to a conclusion with fewer casualties overall? And that's an interesting historical question, and people can argue it either way.
My view on this is that the war was close to an end anyway, and dropping the bomb was about future wars. It was not about ending World
War II. So fair enough. That's a good point. I think the interesting case philosophically, sort of from a moral point of view, is let's suppose somehow you knew that you would ultimately save some significant number of lives by dropping the bomb. Would that justify dropping it? And I think some people would still say no.
Yeah, I would still say no.
Yeah, okay, so you're one of these, you're like Ned.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess the question is, all right, so most people, and these are not people like me, these are other people, but most people believe in something called just war. Like, there is such a thing as a just war.
Right, sure.
Like, Augustine famously argued for this.
Right. Well,
if you believe in that there is such a thing as a just war, then it would be better to enter a just war than assassinate, you know, a 14-year-old girl because she's pregnant with, you know, a contender to the throne, because that has, there's no just assassination,
in the
same way that there could be a just war. In other words, the people on the front lines that have, you know, volunteered to fight, or, you know, these are big strapping men who, you know, they're made to fight, you know, that kind of thing, that kind of rationale.
Yeah.
That's more honorable. Like what Ned says, like, look her in the eye, hear her last words, see if you can still go through with it. You know, he has this idea that there's an honorable way to do these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
So because most people believe in a just war, they'd be happy to throw off the Dothraki 30 years from now because, you know, we're probably due for a war anyway.
Yeah, right.
You know, that kind of thing. I don't view it that way, but I was curious to hear what you said, because I think Picel does make an interesting point.
Yeah.
You know, maybe killing two people is better than killing 10,000 people.
I do think there are actions that are simply forbidden, irrespective of the consequences. I do think that. So in this case, this looks like a case like that.
Right.
For me.
Okay. Would you kill Hitler?
Well.
Would you kill Hitler as a baby?
As a baby. kind of knowing what he would do in the future.
Well, I'm asking because Danny's going to burn down cities and try to take over the world. That's basically what we think will happen with Danny.
Sure, but nobody knows that.
Yeah, but in retrospect, let's say Picel knew that Danny was going to become...
You want a time travel scenario.
I time travel is a part of this story, so this is not out of the realm of possibility. If Blood Raven were to come to Picel...
Right.
And say, hey, guess what? That girl across the sea, you know, she's going to burn lots of people alive, lots of people alive. And she's going to try to take over the world. And there's going to be tens of thousands of people that die in that process. It'd be better to kill her now. And then Picel brings this information to Robert. Maybe he should be listened to. Maybe Picel's making an interesting point.
If someone were somehow to impart to me knowledge that an infant in front of me, that if I weren't to kill this infant will go on to become a historical monster that kills millions of people.
It's going to be the next Stalin, you know.
So even if I knew that, this is a difficult question, okay? So I'm not very confident.
Uh-huh.
But even if I knew that, I think I shouldn't kill that baby.
Well, you're a kind-hearted.
Well, some people will find that outrageous, and I just want to recognize that it's that's controversial. But I just, as I said before, I think there are certain things you simply are not permitted to do.
So the right thing for Chad is to befriend the baby until the baby becomes a teenager, and then do an Of Mice and Men Lenny situation on the grown baby.
Well,
that's what I heard. That's what I heard you say, Chad.
Well, what I said was, I'm told that if I don't kill this child, then he will go on to do this. It would be sort of odd for me to not kill him, and then act like, even though I know that having not killed him, he's going to do these things, to then try to prevent him from doing those things. That would be kind of an odd choice, right? Since I know that he's going to do them because I didn't kill him, right? That's part of the setup. So it's a very weird case, because how do you ever know something like that? I mean, so it's a very difficult hypothetical.
Yeah, no, that's fine. And honestly, knowing that about you, I feel a lot better with all of the times you babysat my children.
Well, yeah. Well, you've got great kids, so there's no worries. Even if I held the other view.
I'm going to read a synopsis of this chapter.
Okay.
The small council debates the merits of assassinating Daenerys, who is pregnant. Ned and Barristan try to convince Robert not to kill children. Pycelle, Renly, Littlefinger, and Varys all side with Robert. After questioning Robert's honor and courage, Ned's argument escalates to defiance. When he refuses to carry out the king's decision, Robert warns him that he will find a new hand of the king. Ned resigns. Ned leaves and plans to return to Winterfell as soon as he can. He ponders again the plot against Bran, news of Catelyn's capture of Tyrion, and wonders if the recent murders at King's Landing might be connected. Just as Ned is planning to leave, Littlefinger enters and promises to take him to one last brothel, the one that Jory wasn't able to find. Chad Carmichael, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about Robert.
Okay.
He is filled with rage about these Targaryens, right?
He hates them.
He hates them. It's been 15 years.
He wants to kill every Targaryen.
Ned is a little taken aback. Ned seems to think at a certain point, gosh, is he still this upset? Now, this is a little bit puzzling. I want to observe. It's a little bit puzzling because Robert doesn't even want the throne anymore.
Yeah, well, he's a contradiction.
So it's Robert. Not like he's feeling, oh, they'll come and take my beloved throne away. They'll take my power away. They'll take my station as the king will be threatened. That can't be what's connecting emotionally for him. He says at one point that he feels that they're like an axe over his neck. So maybe that's what it is. That he just feels physically threatened by them.
Well, here's the thing about Robert, okay? So Robert's a blip on the radar. There have been Targaryen kings and queens for hundreds of years.
Sure.
He's a usurper as long as any Targaryen is still living. Any Targaryen. The narrative about his throne involves this usurping business. Sure. If all the Targaryens are gone, then that's not even a question anymore. But I don't think that that's totally what motivates him. I think that the key thing that motivates him is, it, like, deep down in his soul, he's a Targaryen killing machine.
Yeah.
He's like the Terminator, and every Targaryen needs to die.
Yeah, here's what I want to say. I think that if Robert did and become the, what did you say last time? The king who became a hedge knight?
Yeah, yeah.
If he followed that fantasy and he actually did that, I think he would still hate Targaryens.
I think so too.
And he would want to kill them.
Still. Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right.
So it can't be about the throne. And it probably isn't even really that he feels threatened by them. He just has a kind of primitive hatred of these people.
Well, this is what war does to people, Chad. I was once in a group of adults. And we were all on this trip together. And this guy who was probably in his 40s was talking about how he never understood how his father could continue to hate Koreans so long after the war. Mm-hmm. And then, but he was also confessing, like, but I fought in Iraq and I see that same tendency in me. Like, it's hard for me to stop hating the enemy, mm-hmm. even though I'm supposed to, like, be this civilian on, you know, back in the States living a normal life.
Sure.
There's this deep-seated hatred that's sort of been pounded into me.
Yeah.
So he's sort of confessing to that own thing about himself.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And it's one of these casualties of war that, I don't know if you've ever heard this term, moral injury. Mm-hmm. You know, so you can, you know, PTSD is sort of the damage that happens to soldiers when they come back and they have to deal with their trauma. But part of the loss is that they've done things that have injured their own sense of morality.
Yeah.
And so they can't unlive those things either.
Right.
And I think that that's part of the problem of war. And I think Robert probably has that for Targaryens in a way that maybe like someone like Barristan Selmy doesn't have.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, it's really, it's deep. It's core to who Robert is.
Right. It's funny though, because I mean, maybe I don't know exactly. Maybe, I don't know, maybe we haven't even been told what all of Robert's experiences with the Targaryens. Maybe we haven't been given a story of that in detail.
Yeah.
But my just vague impression is that Robert had this sort of epic battle with Rhaegar, right?
Right.
But it's like a fight worthy of a song or something like this. It's not like some sort of hellish war situation where he was threatened for weeks and months by hordes of Targaryens.
Oh, he went to war where there were like big battles where he was fighting big battles. Blondies. And he was fighting, killed a lot of blondies.
Is that right? I mean, I guess that's what I'm wondering is Targaryens seem like they show up here and there, but I probably imagined the war being mostly between like bannermen of the Targaryens.
So interestingly enough, you know, all that we've been talking about this, I do think he hates Targaryens. The reason why Jon Arryn and Ned didn't take the throne is that Robert had a better claim to the throne.
Mm-hmm.
Because way back in the day, Baratheons intermingled with Targaryens. And so Baratheons sort of have a little bit of Targaryen blood in them.
Okay.
So that's interesting. I don't know if that goes into any of his psychological makeup or not, but
right.
It is interesting to note.
Yeah.
I think, Chad, that Renly has designs for the throne. And I think that we've seen several hints on this. And you've been reluctant to kind of concede on this point.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to make my case. I think that Renly is doing what he can to kind of undermine Robert and make alliances with the Highgarden and whatnot. Because I think he's thinking about, you know, what's the world going to be like when Robert's gone?
Mm-hmm.
In this chapter, he is very vocal about killing Dany.
Right.
He wants to kill Dany. He says it should have been done long ago.
Yep.
And the only reason to take a hard stance on that is to protect this new Baratheon dynasty that he envisions. I don't feel like he's the kind of person that would just... I think he's being self-serving, in other words, when he suggests that there's no question about it. We should absolutely kill Dany. What do you think?
So what I think is that I have been skeptical that Renly had designs on the throne earlier in the story. Obviously, at some point, he begins to have... I mean, certainly after Robert is gone, he wants to take the throne.
Yeah.
I agree that it's plausible that somewhere in here, somewhere in this time frame, he may have begun to realize Robert's finished.
Yeah, and I'm arguing that the reason why he's taking the stance on Dany that he is that he's already thinking, that's my throne.
I mean, I don't think that that's I don't think that's implausible, but it seems very much a conjecture to me. I don't see any positive evidence for it.
Well, I failed again.
I failed to
bring just a plain, obvious truth before you and have it.
Well, you kind of veer back and forth in an irrational way. last time we talked, you were making the case that the Hound had brotherly love for Gregor.
I did not. I said he hated him.
You said that he had.
He hated him, but that he psychologically couldn't pull the trigger.
So that's what I meant. And now you're saying that Renly is eager to take his brother's place on the throne.
Yeah.
I think Renly's definitely a better guy than the Hound.
I don't know. I think he's just smarter. He just knows how to use political weapons in the way that the Hound doesn't care about.
Renly, oddly enough, I mean, because you don't hear a whole lot from Renly is one of the more ordinary people in the story. it seems to me.
I think he knows how to fly under the radar, and I think he makes his move almost perfectly. And I think he probably would have won the War of Five Kings if not for Stannis's chicanery.
I don't know that Renly ever does anything that's like really alienating to me.
Well, he's a political animal, and he thinks the more friends I have, the better for me. And I think that Martin writes him that way.
My feeling is that your view that there may be some kind of almost instinctive brotherly loyalty built into people, at least in some cases, I think is much more plausible about Renly than it is about the Hound. And I think given that Renly never really does anything that's very dark, it's kind of weird to conjecture that he's thinking about getting rid of his brother.
I think that he has designs on the throne, and that's why he wants Danny out of the way.
I would say it's possible, but I would like to think that Renly, if he thought his brother was in trouble, that he would do more to try to help his brother than this. I mean, it would be nice if there was one character in the whole story that was not like a complete moral idiot.
No, I think you have those. You absolutely have those.
Who did you have in mind?
I wouldn't consider. Okay, so your language. I'm just going to remind you of your language.
Yeah.
The phrase you used was complete moral idiot.
Yeah, fair enough.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say Jon Snow is not a complete moral idiot.
All right, fair enough.
I don't think Samwell Tarly is a complete moral idiot.
Yeah.
I don't think Davos is a complete moral idiot.
I guess these guys don't cross lines that are completely unrelatable, right?
What do you think about Rob? Do you think Rob is a complete moral idiot?
No, he's a good guy.
I think he's driven by vengeance.
Yeah.
I don't think that demonstrates moral fortitude.
Yeah. Well, sure. I mean, you can be flawed without being a complete moral idiot, right? Okay, so you've made your case. There are a few characters.
All right. I'll tell you who is an idiot. I don't know if he's a moral idiot or not, but this is the most idiotic chapter from Ned.
Okay.
So I've really tried to defend Ned for as long as I can. I don't think Ned's stupid, but at times, boy, he can really be stupid. And this chapter is him at his most stupid.
You think he is stupid to insist on this kind of high-minded approach to the Targaryen issue?
I don't know what he should have done. Yeah. I don't know what he should have done in that conversation with Robert. What I do know for certain is that he should not have resigned Hand of the King. He doesn't want the job. He hates the job. I get that. He can't abide what Robert's doing. And I can see wanting to kind of throw a grenade on the table, you know, to sort of have that moral high ground. But his wife has just captured Tyrion and he knows it.
Yeah.
He needs to be doing things that will allow for that situation to play out in a way that will be beneficial to Catelyn. Because by resigning the Hand of the King and by making an enemy of Robert, now he's lost his best political asset against Tywin Lannister and Jaime Lannister and Cersei Lannister and the whole brood of them, right? So he should be smart enough to know that Kat is actually in trouble. She needs help. He should be doing everything he can to use his station to get her out of that predicament. Once she's safe and sound, I think that he can be as morally high-minded as he needs to be, and he can quit if he wants to.
So what you're saying is that to keep your wife safe, you would sign your name on an order to murder a 14-year-old girl.
To keep my wife safe, I would sign my name on an order to kill the future Hitler. Yes.
That wasn't the question. A 14-year-old girl who's pregnant.
Okay, so here's what I would have done.
Yeah.
I would have said, Robert, don't worry about it. I'm going to take care of this for you. All right. You never have to think about Dany Targaryen ever again. I am absolutely going to take care of this. We're going to put down this rebellion before it starts. You can trust me, I'm your best friend. Don't promise to kill the child yet. Just exploit the trust that you've earned with Robert. Go help your wife. Figure that out. Get her safe and sound up in Winterfell. Keep your office. And then figure it out when you're out of the room. He's a hothead. He blows up the whole situation in that moment. He's unyielding.
Yeah.
He knows he's crossed the line with Robert. He starts questioning not just his honor, but his courage.
Yeah.
And that with Robert is a bridge too far. His timing is just absolutely horrible. Delay it a little bit.
Yeah.
Help your wife and then figure it out later.
I mean, I agree when people criticize Ned for not being very, very good at strategy. He's not. I agree with that. In this moment, I feel a little proud of him that it sort of feels like he's saying, you know what? Some things are more important than even my life. I mean, I sort of admire someone when they have that.
I guess so. It doesn't help Danny at all. What he does not help Danny at all. They still try to assassinate her. So he may win the argument, but he absolutely doesn't win the relationship. And that's what he needs to do in that moment. He needs to win the relationship with Robert. That's what's better for Danny. That's what's going to be better for everyone.
I think there's something noble about taking a stand in the way that he did. What I would criticize him for is I don't know why he's moving so slowly after that episode. He should be moving much more quickly. He should not be talking to Littlefinger.
Well, he actually does come to that conclusion. He's like, look, I normally don't take a boat, but maybe I will. Maybe I'll take the next boat out.
Yeah,
that's how he's thinking. And then Littlefinger comes in, and of course it's his curiosity. He's like, well, I should see this through. Whatever the case is, right. He should not be listening to Littlefinger. He should actually be getting on the boat.
Yeah.
But this is when it, I think, falls apart for Ned.
Here's a part in this chapter. He says, this is after he's left. And Littlefinger is announced to him, and it says, Ned was half tempted to turn him away, but thought better of it. He was not free yet. Until he was, he must play their games.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, this is terrible. He should have said, I'm not interested in talking to Littlefinger. Tell Littlefinger to go, whatever.
Right.
And that would have been a much better move there. He involves Littlefinger. It's like, Ned, you're not good at playing these people's games. What you need to do is you need to get your daughter and leave right now.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, that could have worked. He would not be in that situation if he hadn't resigned his office.
But yeah, sure, but he did, and I admire him for taking a stand. But it's time to leave at that point. And I would say to him, look, if the first boat out is like 2 hours from now, that's too long. You need to leave now. Now. You need to leave.
Yeah, no, I get it. I get it.
And now he's going back to the north. There's going to be war, so he needs to make preparations for war.
Notable introductions in this chapter. Roose Bolton, we hear about him for the first time.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. We hear that Barristan Selmy fought for the Targaryens, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of the battle, he was maimed or something. And that there was a decision to let him keep his life.
Yeah.
And Robert showed mercy, whereas Roose decided to kill him, or he suggested that they should kill him. The other thing we hear about for the very first time is the Faceless Men.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's interesting that this introduction comes right after the Arya chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this question about whether or not Ned should keep allowing this Bravosi sword master to train Arya.
Yeah.
And then we hear about these faceless men in Braavos or whatever, who were sort of really expensive assassins.
Right.
So I think you see here Martin's seeds. I think he has this idea for where Arya is going to go.
Right.
Even this early.
Yeah, I think that's right. I got one other question for you.
Okay.
So Varys pretty clearly advocates for killing Daenerys. Is that really what he wants?
I don't think so. No.
I don't either. I guess he just saw that, oh, well, this is where the majority is, and my vote won't help if I vote against them.
He's very strange in this chapter in that he's just told Ned in the previous chapter that he knows about the Tears of Lice and knows that this is what killed Jon Arryn, right?
Yeah.
And then in this chapter, he suggests using the Tears of Lice on this dragon queen. Mm-hmm. And Pycelle looks at him like horrified.
Right.
Robert even says that, you know, poison is sort of a coward's weapon. So Varys is kind of playing into this role. Like, I want these people to think that I'm nefarious and cowardly. It's almost like he's playing up this eunuch role for them.
Yeah. But also maybe he wanted to see Pycelle's reaction.
Maybe he wanted to see Pycelle's reaction.
This is the thing with Varys. You can never tell, right? It's like he's
thinking, one of my best political assets is that people don't view me as a direct threat.
Yeah.
I'm a spider, you know, I crawl around.
But it really does sometimes feel like Varys is playing some grandmaster chess game.
Yeah, it does.
I'm just not qualified to know why he moved his pawn just then.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think there's a little bit of skullduggery happening here.
Yeah.
I think that Martin is trying to sort of throw us off the scent by using Varys's icky personality to to make us quite, at least, you know, Ned questions him and the king's going to question the honor of the suggestion. And I don't really think that Varys wants Dany dead, but in that room, he absolutely has to appear that he wants Dany dead.
Yeah.
That's my take on it.
Yeah, that seems right. That seems right. But he doesn't really want her dead.
I don't think so, no.
Hear the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur: Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was, and those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
And how Steve and I cover Oathkeeper. This is the episode where Jaime sends Brienne off to find Sansa and visits Tyrion in his cell for the first time. We see the horrible things that are happening beyond the wall at Craster's Keep, and we find out that Lady Olenna is behind Joffrey's murder. Here is comic Steve Osborne.
Steve, do you remember when Michael Jordan decided that he was going to try a Hitler mustache?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good test to find out what kind of influence you have, right?
I think it's either a test or my take on it was, it's the most confident anyone has ever been in the history of humankind. It's like, right. I'm Michael Jordan. I know that you associate this mustache with Hitler, but I think I can pull it off.
Yeah, that's a pretty bold move that you could say, I'm bigger than Hitler. Like, you know, when the Beatles said they're bigger than Jesus, like that was controversial. But to say that you're bigger than Hitler, like that's even bigger, right? I mean, that's even more so because everybody's like, yeah, I mean, like everybody for the most part, with maybe exception of Mel Gibson, believes in Hitler.
I think Dany is the most confident she's ever been in this episode.
Yeah, I could see that.
I think she may be the most confident anyone's ever been in the history of West. She's as confident as a Michael Jordan.
Michael Jordan with the Hitler mustache. Yeah, no, so, I mean, she's... So what does this do for... Because we've talked about her being sort of altruistic to some degree, right? Or at least when it comes to the idea of freeing slaves. And, you know, I've kind of been in the camp that, yeah, I mean, there's an advantage to that, right? I mean, it's not completely without, you know, some self-serving quality, right?
Well, she definitely sees herself as a good guy. I think someone like Littlefinger would be like, there's no such thing as good guys. There's winners and losers, and I'm going to be a winner. But I think she really looks at herself as, I'm the good guy, therefore I need to become a winner. And while that has merit, I think that it was glaring to me that she's decided to repay torture with torture.
Right.
And there's no altruism there in my mind.
Right, I agree. And this was a point of conversation because Heather's, you know, more... She sees Dany as being somebody who's, you know, she was under a certain degree of slavery herself. And so she is hellbent on freeing slaves. And that's coming from a real true spot. But we did agree that, you know, now that she is doing the kind of repay torture with torture, it's clouded for sure.
Like I said, she's confident. She's confident. Yeah. What she's doing is right.
Right. And we're seeing like all these elements of weakness or at least deficiencies from all these different kings. And I think Tywin gives us a nice summation of that the episode prior when he's asking Tommen to say, what's the most important part about being a king?
I think that this episode has some of the best dialogue of the entire series. And I'm just thinking about the Bronn-Jaime duel.
Yeah.
And then that sort of jumps right to Tyrion and Jaime in jail, which is just dynamite.
Yeah, great scene.
That jumps to Sansa and Littlefinger in the ship, and that jumps to Olenna and Margaery, where basically Olenna reveals that she was behind the whole thing.
Right. And, you know, I was kind of sort of on the right track, I guess, with the necklace, right? But not...
Right. So the necklace... Right. So the necklace was important, and so it's sort of like... Sansa, clearly unwittingly participating.
Right.
But if ever it came back to her, like, okay, so you were wearing the necklace that had the poison, and you're telling us that you had nothing to do with it? You know, that kind of thing.
Right.
So she did kind of participate unwittingly. And part of it was through this back channel relationship with Sir Dantos, who still sucks even from the grave. And, you know, Olenna and Littlefinger are the kind of the puppeteers here, right?
Well, yeah. And I mean,
because what does Littlefinger already... do? Littlefinger shoots Dantos in the face, takes the necklace, pushes it off the side of the boat, and I think it like falls right onto Dantos's body.
Yeah.
Clearly, Littlefinger is, I think he may be covering his tracks.
Yeah, and that's the thing about Sansa puts her in a position where it's like, well, what are you going to do? You're going to rat me out? Who has more to, who would have more of a motive in this case? And it was your necklace.
Yeah.
How do you want, so no matter what, I feel she's just, I mean, again, Sansa just continues to get screwed over. Because now she's a prisoner again. I mean, now she's a new prisoner in a, you know, a different way, right? I mean, what are your options?
Yeah, I mean, where's Littlefinger gonna take her? Not home, not to Winterfell.
No,
he's taking her to the Eyrie, which would be it's her aunt, and the Eyrie, you know, her aunt's a little bit touched, but you would think that'd be a little safer place than King's Landing, anyway.
It depends. It depends on Littlefinger's plans, right? I mean. He doesn't get Sansa out of the goodness of his heart. We know this.
I love this dialogue between Tyrion and Jaime in the jail cell. These two, you get the sense that there's a long history there. I think these actors are doing a great job of... feels like there's a long familiarity between these two characters.
Yeah, they feel like old brothers talking.
Yeah. And interesting that Jaime still kind of wants Tyrion to play along with the, you know... Joffrey's not really my son, that kind of thing. That was
right, right.
I thought that was great. I love that scene. Jon's up north, and the idea here is that Jon is driven by what he thinks justice looks like, and so that there's this interesting parallel between Jon's sense of justice and Dany's sense of justice.
Mm-hmm.
So Jon says, if Mormont was our father, then we need to go get justice for him. Danny's notion is, okay, these slavers tortured and killed these slaves. Now we're going to torture and kill the slavers. And I think that on paper, those things may look like they kind of balance out. But then the question is John the kind of guy that would torture someone to death?
Right. I don't get that sense.
So, yeah. So I think that there's this nuance here between the two. Like, there's certainly a parallel. There's a difference between someone who's seeking justice by way of torture.
Right.
And, all right, so Carl, who has a nickname, he's called Clubfoot Carl.
That's he's not Low Rent Defoe.
No, he's not Low Rent Defoe. And it seems like he's kind of thinking, you know, Craster had a pretty good idea. I could just be the new Craster.
Right.
And when I'm drunk, I'm going to talk a lot of shit. The rape scenes at Craster's Keep, the directors actually, quote unquote, toned them down because the original footage was a bit much.
Ah, okay.
So that's what toned down looks like.
All right. Okay.
And then finally we see, the White Walker's daddy daycare.
Yeah, we do.
Their version of a pacifier, you turn their eyes blue.
Yeah, it's very sweet. I mean, it's a lullaby of sorts.
So, a little bit more about the White Walkers here.
Yeah, so we get a sense that they're, like, because I guess up to this point, right, we've just been under the impression that they're kind of this roaming band of zombies.
We got the sense that, okay, so a little hint that they like to cut up body pieces of horses and humans and, like, arrange them in a...
Right.
A little depiction of the Milky Way. It's like they're astronomers or something. But
yeah, a little something for Pinterest.
That was right. Their Pinterest work. So you got the little sense that maybe there's a culture behind this because they're creating artwork or something. And now we get the sense that looks like is kind of a ritual stone circle, but made of ice. So suggesting some kind of religious adherence. So I don't know. I mean, we don't have a lot to go on.
No, but then we see some, you know, what is this? This king-like figure that's doesn't look like your typical White Walker.
Doesn't look like your typical White Walker. That's right.
So the suggestion being that there's another, I mean, maybe this was already explicit and I just didn't catch it, but it suggests that what we're seeing from these undead is maybe a different part of this army. Like it's an acquisition, much in the same way that Danny's freeing the slaves and creating, creating followers and or soldiers.
Yeah. So there's a lot of sort of fan theories about this guy. And I mean, just tons of fan theories about this guy, because they haven't had really any dialogue on these people's lips. So you can't really tell us a whole lot. So a lot of fans went to the lore and the legends behind, you know, trying to figure out who this guy is. And that's detailed in Gods of Thrones, Steve, a chapter called Crueler Gods. So if you're interested, you can pick that up.
Yeah, you and your product placement.
Yeah, I know. I'm just a shill. I'm a shill for Big Ice. Jaime and Cersei. Their relationship is not improving.
It's complicated, as Facebook might say.
It's a little complicated, and it could be that we've seen the last of the twincest. It's like, I think that we're supposed to think, all right, yeah, so Jamie's just, he's a changed man. Like, we're supposed to, I feel like I'm supposed to have forgotten what just happened between those two. And
yeah,
This
episode I found to be more, I mean, not that I was like, oh yeah, that Jamie guy, but I mean, this one seems to be the more difficult for me to reconcile, because I'm not sure what I'm supposed to feel or what the intent is. Cause this is where I'm like, are you actually supposed to be moving towards Team Jamie at some point here? Because it doesn't seem like you helped with the last episode.
Right. Yeah, this is, we're going to have to wait and see on this. Do you get the sense that Jamie and Brienne are falling in love? I mean, we know that they've fallen into respect.
I can see Brienne with Jamie. And I can see Jamie thinking what he's experiencing is the thing that he's heard about called love.
Huh. Interesting.
I think Jamie's. I'm gonna go. I'm moving more towards the. Yeah, Jamie's sort of a sociopath, sort of beyond repair. And everything we're gonna get from him at this point is kind of like anything good is an impersonation.
Yeah, I like it. I like that a lot. Brienne gets 3 gifts. She gets a Valyrian steel sword. She names it Oathkeeper. She gets a new suit of armor, which is black.
Yeah.
I like it. You know, better than the pink dress.
Yeah, it suits her.
And she gets Pod.
She gets Pod. Which, by the way, I mean, if things between her and Jamie don't work out, she may be pleasantly surprised with Pod.
I mean, look, Pod is probably not her equal, but just as a boy toy, I think that she...
Oh, yeah.
You
could do way worse.
You could do worse than Pod. Okay, so this doesn't happen in the show, so I'm going to tell you a little something that happens in the books. Jamie commissions Brienne to go off and find these Stark girls to kind of fulfill this oath. And she, you know, she gets the sword. Sword is made of, you know, Lannister gold and Valyrian steel. And she gets this Lannister-made armor, and she's off on the road, and she's looking for Arya and Sansa. And because Lady Stoneheart is out there, so Catelyn's sort of, I don't know, pet cemetery self is out there.
Right, right.
Her little group comes upon Brienne. And Catelyn basically says, hey, what the hell? Like, now you're working for Jaime Lannister and you're wearing his steel and you're carrying his sword. And whatever happened to this oath? And Brienne's like, no, 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 you don't get it. And Catelyn basically says, prove it by killing Jaime. And Brienne refuses and she says, okay, prove it by killing Jaime or I will hang you. And so Brienne has to decide between killing Jaime or being hanged herself. And that's kind of the cliffhanger at the end of one of the books. And then we don't hear about her at all until the following book. Basically, Brienne goes and finds Jaime and says, "Hey, I found one of the Stark girls. She's in the next village. Come with me and we'll go get her and we'll fulfill our oath." But we happen to know that both Stark girls aren't anywhere near that area. So Brienne kind of lies to Jaime and tricks him into coming with her. And the inference here is that she is taking him to Lady Stark. But that is an inference, because that's kind of where the last book ends.
Oh, okay, wow.
So clearly none of that happens in the show, because Catelyn's...
We don't have a weekend at Catelyn's.
Yeah, no weekend at Catelyn's. So that's kind of for book readers, you know, that's kind of a complication to their relationship that we're not going to see come to fruition.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing that I thought was really interesting is that, so there was a, Bronn made some kind of reference to the fact that Tyrion, when Tyrion was a prisoner at the Eyrie, he demanded trial by combat, and the first thing he did is he demanded his brother to be his champion.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of suggests, okay, well, Tyrion's in jail and there's going to be a trial. What if Tyrion demands trial by combat? If this had happened a few months ago, maybe, just maybe, he would have called upon his brother.
Right.
And his brother would have had to decide between Tyrion and Cersei or whatever.
Right, right.
Which he's kind of in that predicament anyway, but the fact that he has no hand means, yeah, Tyrion does not have that asset. He can't call on Jaime for trial by combat.
Right. No, no doubt. And who, yeah, exactly.
So the fact that Jaime lost a hand has not just complicated his narrative, now it's complicated Tyrion's narrative.
I'm into that. I think we covered...
Did you notice that Kill the Masters was written on a wall in English?
Yes. Yes, I did.
Did that take you out of it?
A little bit. Because I guess this scene is him going, "I don't know what this says."
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
For this bird's eye view, I'd like to include this short excerpt of my conversation with Jan Doolittle Wilson on Jamie's character arc. Jamie's such a complicated character, and so that anyone that loves to follow Jamie probably has a complicated relationship with that character. And I think Jan brings that out really well in this conversation. And I think it is somewhat of a different view than Steve's view of Jamie, which is a show-only view. So I thought I'd include that here. Here is Jan Doolittle Wilson. I think Jamie views himself as a lion among, you know, sheep.
Yeah.
And every now and again, he'll find a sheep, a sheep. Yeah, I think that is the singular, right?
Yeah.
For some reason, I got a little bit confused there. I do think he finds a sheep interesting, and he will, he'll sort of befriend the sheep and learn a little bit about the sheep. But at the end of the day, he's really true to his own egotism. And even though I find him a very interesting egotist, I think that that's kind of core to his character. But I do think that maybe Jaime and Tyrion are on sort of parallel story arcs, but going in different directions.
Yeah.
So Tyrion is heroic, and we love Tyrion for his truth-telling and his humor and whatnot. And then we see him descend into this villainous character, whereas Jaime is introduced something of a villain, and then, of course, we see that he's got a lot of the same complexity that Tyrion has. And that becomes interesting, and so we end up sort of developing a certain kind of empathy for Jaime later in the books. Yeah. But that's my own reading of it. I don't know. What's your take on Jaime?
I have so many thoughts about Jaime. If you, at some point when you do another Jaime podcast, I would love to be a part of it. But he's actually one of my favorite characters for a lot of the reasons you just stated. And I'm somewhat reluctant to tell people that Jaime's one of my favorite characters.
Well, sure.
Because he does horrific things, right? Uh-huh. I mean, we're introduced to him pushing a child out of a window. I mean, so when you say, oh, I love this character who pushes a child out of a window, it makes you sound like you're this horrible person, right? But I love him for that complexity you just described, uh-huh. right? Any kind of character that defies expectations, that has these multiple layers, that has both the moments of just incredible heroism, but also just incredible, horrible choices and villainy and even a hint of evilness to their character, right? Mm-hmm. I find that incredibly compelling. And it's part of the reason why, you know, George Martin is such a master storyteller. So Jamie's interesting.
Well,
I think
it's
he's interesting
like,
from a disability theory standpoint, but he's also just interesting just in terms of a literary standpoint.
Yeah, I think that there's enough groundwork laid with Jaime that you realize how much of his identity is wrapped up in that sword hand of his.
That sword hand. Yeah. It's who he
is. And so when he loses it, he's still
you know that he hasn't lost his self, because he's more complex than the sword hand, and yet there's enough groundwork laid for that character that now you're thinking, oh, now he's so, like, he was interesting, but now he's infinitely more interesting.
Yeah.
Knowing now that he's lost the thing that has sort of fed his ego all those years.
Yes.
Anyway.
And he doesn't turn into a miraculously saintly person after he loses his hand, which, again, from a disability standpoint is great, yeah, because we don't want disability to signal some, like, oh, now he's an angel. Mm-hmm. He's still deeply, deeply flawed, mm-hmm, after he loses his hand. He just, again, offers us a different point of view of the world from this new vantage point.
And he doesn't gain some sort of superpower because of it.
Thank God. Right? I mean, how often have we seen that, right? So he, mm-hmm, is kind of the same person he was. He is just able to gain new insights and have new forms of knowledge, mm-hmm, because his identity has shifted so much, and how people see him has shifted so much. Mm-hmm. Nobody would dare laugh at Jaime Lannister before. And suddenly he knows now what it's like to be humiliated.
Yeah.
He knows what it's like to feel powerless. He knows what it's like to not be able to fight and defend himself. That is completely foreign to him until he loses that hand. And so, much like Tyrion, who has had a lifetime of practice, Jaime has to come up with new strategies. I always relied on my sword hand. I don't have that anymore. How do I survive this new world? And it's fascinating to see how that develops.
Yeah. My thanks to Jan, as always, for her perspective. If you're interested in looking at Jan's book, Becoming Disabled, it's published with Lexington Books. Of course, you can buy it on Amazon. It's called Becoming Disabled, Forging a Disability View of the World. It's on the expensive side, but it's a fascinating read. And so if you're interested in thinking about disability and seeing what is going on in the academic world in this discussion, it's a great book to pick up. And that's all for this week.